Sorry, just a minute. Ladies and gentlemen, members of the press, good evening, candidates, AAW members and guests. I'm Stevia Wilson-Shaw, current president of AA Atascadero, and I would like to welcome you to this, our April general meeting, a candidate forum for the 24th congressional seat. We are so glad you could join us tonight. Some of you may not have heard of AAUW, that is the American Association of University Women, a national organization. Since 1881, we have been advancing equity for girls and women through advocacy, education, philanthropy, and research. The Atascadero branch was the first in San Luis Obispo County, founded in 1937. We have been building and supporting this community for almost 80 years by promoting equity, funding education and leadership training for girls and women. We are currently offering college scholarships to women returning to school who are part of our North County area. As part of our theme this year, Shape the Future, we are focusing on voter registration and education for women. As a dynamic organization, we are there for one another in many ways, always looking for ways to empower each other and improve our community. Atascadero AAUW has created a number of important groups and services in the North County, including Friends of the Library, Mobile Meals, the North County Women's Shelter. In addition to these groups, our members currently support ECHO, the Great Bots Robotics Team, the Boys and Girls Club of North County, CASA, the Adult Daycare Center, the Latino Outreach Council, the League of Women Voters, and so much more. Our membership is open to all women and men who hold an associate, baccalaureate, or higher degree to bring people together for the common goal of breaking through educational and economic barriers for women and girls. Out in the hall, we have AAUW membership applications, information on our local scholarship application, voter registration materials, and candidate literature that we urge you to take. We also would encourage you to take a voter card for registration form with you if you have a family member or neighbor who is not yet registered to vote. And now I would like to thank Grenda Ernst for organizing this evening's event and Shirley Summers, our moderator. I would also like to thank the AAUW Atascadero Voter Task Force for assisting this evening. We also have these little flyers out in the hallway. This is going to be televised on Channel 21, is that right? Yeah. And so you can watch it later, or anybody you know that wasn't able to attend that wants to watch it can do that by going to their website. And now let me introduce you to Shirley Summers, this evening's moderator. Shirley is a 45-year resident of Atascadero, has served on the Atascadero Advisory Committee prior to incorporation, and is a former Atascadero City Planning Commissioner. She is also an experienced moderator and well-known in the North County for her nonpartisan approach to issues. Thank you, Shirley.
Thank you, Stevia. Good evening. I, too, would like to welcome all of you to this evening's candidate forum for the 24th Congressional District. First of all, I want to take care of a few housekeeping issues. The restrooms are right outside in the lobby there. If you go out the door and turn to the left, there are the restrooms there. We also have coffee and cookies, so hopefully you were able to get some as you came in. But please feel free to help yourself, you know, as we may be taking a break later on. Tonight, we're going to be hearing from all nine candidates for the 24th Congressional District. And I wish to further thank Grenda Ernst for all of the time that she put in coordinating with all of the candidates and their representatives and getting the room available for us and even going so far as to get the key so we could get in tonight. So, Grenda, would you please stand up? Thank you. Thank you for all of your work. The forum this evening is being sponsored by the Voters Task Force, which is a committee within the Atascadero branch of AAUW. And so I would like all of those who are on the Voters Task Force to please stand up and be recognized. Thank you. We talked at great length on how to provide an evening where candidates can share with you the issues that are the most important to them, and for you, their constituents, to ask the questions on the issues most important to you and to hear their responses to those questions. So we have decided on a forum rather than on a debate. A forum allows each candidate to express his or her own views on an issue without regard to or comment on the views of other candidates. In order to facilitate the process, all questions are going to be in a written format. As you came in, you were given a 3x5 card and a pencil. And so if you would write one question on a card, and when you have written that question, if you will hold it up, there will be a proctor who will come around and pick up that question from you and will also give you another card. We have plenty of cards, so we're not going to run out. You can ask as many questions as you want, and we will ask as many as time will permit. Would the proctors please, like, kind of hold their hands up so that they will know who will be coming around and collecting the question cards? Thank you. We also, once your questions are written, they will be taken to a bipartisan panel of AAUW members. They will look at the questions, weeding out any duplicate questions, and attempt to see that a variety of topics relevant to the 24th Congressional District are able to be covered within our time structure. With those people who are going to be reviewing the questions, please come out so that we can see you.
We're hiding in the hallway.
We want to thank them. It's a very important job because we don't want to be asking the same question multiple times. Candidates, I want to tell you a little bit more about the structure of the evening. Candidates will be given 2 minutes for opening remarks and 1 minute for closing remarks at the end of the forum. As questions are asked of the candidates, they will each have 1 minute to respond to questions that are asked of all candidates. Candidates will be given 2 minutes to respond to questions asked of them individually. For questions asked of an individual candidate, other candidates will be given 1 minute if they wish to state their position on that question. For the sake of time and opportunity to hear on many issues, it is important to conform to the time limits. We have some timers who are seated in the front row, and they have indicators as to, you know, whether you go, and a yellow paddle will be held up for 30 seconds left to go, and then a red stop sign when your time is up. So... At this point, I would like to begin with some introductions, and we will begin the two-minute opening remarks. And so we will start at this end of the table, and here we have Matt Kokkonen, who is a Republican, member of the Republican Central Committee, financial planner, and came to the U.S. from Finland in 1962.
We'll try this one. Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to be here tonight, and thank you for coming here. I appreciate that greatly. It's time that is valuable to you as well. I was born in Finland on a cold winter night, and at the age of 13, my father died, at which point I dragged my mother to the U.S. Embassy in Helsinki, and I said, I want to go to America. She humored me, and we were able to go. I was able to go to the embassy and get my papers, got my papers, and it took me 3 years, at which time I was age 16. I left my home, left everybody, and came to New York by myself. Didn't know anybody in New York. I had one suitcase, and I'm here to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, tonight I have two suitcases. Only in America can you do that. I was fortunate to attend Westmont College in Santa Barbara, where I played soccer. I was known as the Flying Finn, after which I went back and did graduate studies in philosophy and political science in Europe. Came back, started my financial services business, at which time I also got two master's degrees, one in finance, financial services, one in management. And I've been doing that type of work for the last 45 years. I have two children. One of them is a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force Reserves right now. She went to the Air Force Academy, and I supported her for that as well. My son is he's a computer, what I call a computer nerd, and I appreciate having him around. My wife and I have been married for 48 years, and I'm very thankful for her patience and good personality, being able to put up with me all these years. I believe that we have major problems facing us, and the reason I'm running is because I have two wonderful grandchildren. It's for their future. And it's a serious thing. I understand finance. I've been involved with that. And I've been an employer all these years.
Okay.
I also served
you,
in
Mr.
the
Kokanen.
National Guard to serve our country. Thank you very much for being here.
Next, we have Steve Isaacson. He is an independent. He's lived in this district for almost 45 years and in Atascadero for 20 of those years. He's a chief engineer at a local electronics manufacturing company in Los Osos. Mr. Isaacson.
Thank you. Good evening, and thank you for all coming, and I thank the hosts for putting this together. I'm often asked, why am I running? The fact of the matter is, I usually just say, I'm tired of the dysfunctional Congress, and I think it should be working more for the people. Reality is that's just a symptom of the problem. And it's a serious problem, a serious symptom, though. Some of the problems, Congress has lots of problems. They all need to be addressed, but there's nothing more serious than the problem of the budget. They are constitutionally responsible for revenues and taxation and paying the debts, paying the bills. It's been a very, very long time since the budget has been balanced. The Clinton administration claims to have balanced it, but it did it so by borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund and leaving it for another generation to pay that back. They didn't have a plan to pay it back. It would simply come about later. Well, it's time. Social Security Trust Fund has no surpluses anymore. So it's going to have to start being paid back. The only way to do it is to borrow money and put it on the public debt, the more recorded funds. These problems and more, I'm a problem solver. That's why I'm valued at the company I work for, as well as mentoring others. I plan to use those problem-solving skills and understanding the problems next year in Congress. So thank you for all coming out, and I hope you learn much from us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Isaacson. Now we move to Kacho Asajian. He is a Republican, served as past San Luis Obispo County District 4 District Supervisor from 1998 to 2010. Currently, he is a California State Assemblyman. Mr. Asajian.
Thank you. Thank you, ladies of AAW, and thank you all for being here tonight. First, let me start introducing my wife of 32 years, and we're blessed with two children, both luckily out of college and graduated. Myself, I've been here now 45 years. I came to attend Cuesta College. Meanwhile, I work at a gas station in Rio Grande to help put myself through college. End up going to Cal Poly, graduated there with a degree in business administration. The love of the community, to stay local, I end up buying that gas station. And the spirit of the free enterprise got me where I am in the business world. As a self-employed now for 38 years, I had the opportunities of belonging several organizations within the community, which gave me the opportunity to get to know my community and be able to help as needed. Politics was never in the picture, so to say, but while in as a businessman, I was appointed to the Mid-State Fair Board by Pete Wilson, where I served 8 years. That somehow gave me a taste of politics. Later on, when our supervisor was to retire, Ruth Brackett, Ms. Brackett, she came by and said, "Your name keeps coming up. You should consider." I didn't think I would, but I did the smartest thing I could think of, went home, asked my wife, "What do you think?" She said, "Well, do it. And get it out of your system." So I did. I was lucky to be elected, where I served 3 terms. It was a great experience. While serving 3 terms as the county supervisor, I was also appointed by Schwarzenegger to serve on the Coastal Commission. That was also a lot of learning experience, great experience. Our county is in good hands. It has been in good hands, but we also had the recession, which I experienced while serving on the County Board of Supervisors. But very lucky to say that we worked together very well. By the time I left the county, we had $80 million in reserve. That took hard work, but again, we worked for the good of the community. As I was ready to come out, you all know that then Mr. Maldonado.
Thank you, Mr. Asadu. Now we'll move to Helene Schneider. She is a Democrat. She was served on the Santa Barbara City Council since 2003, and she is the current mayor of the city of Santa Barbara.
Well, good evening, and thank you all for being here. I really want to thank AAUW Atascadero for putting this forum on. It's great to see such a full crowd here today. As was mentioned, I'm the mayor of the city of Santa Barbara. I'm currently serving my 2nd term, and I was on the city council before that. The issue that brought me into municipal government life had to do with I was on the city housing authority, and before that, my professional background's in human resources management. I still do some consulting work in that field, but that is another part of what drives me to move forward in this arena. Why I'm so passionate in running for this office is that I think there is a role within the federal government where people can really reach their full potential and where we can give them equal opportunity to do what is best in for their families and in their own communities. And there's ways to do that in a way that when they go to work that they're able to get their job done and focus on getting the job done without being feared of harassment or discrimination based on who they are, who they love, what their health status is, trying to be able to actually focus on the work as opposed to getting extra bills paid for health care or other kind of issues related to keeping a strong family unit together. There's a way that the federal government can work together on helping people in getting good paying jobs in our clean and renewable energy sources. I think here in Central Coast area, we have such great opportunity through our higher educational institutions, through the entrepreneurial spirit here, to really focus on how the government can incentivize things to move into a clean and renewable energy source and help people work on both an environmental strong way as well as an economic vitality way. And finally, I think what the role as mayor that I've worked on, I work with a variety of different people in a well-rounded, politically diverse way in focusing on getting things done in Washington. I think the gridlock in Washington is something we're totally sick of. We need a new experience as mayor and taking that perspective in D.C. to get the job done. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, we'll move to Justin Fareed. He is a Republican, born and raised in Santa Barbara, former legislative aide, and a businessman.
Well, I want to thank you for the opportunity to come here and speak with all of you, and I want to thank you for being here this evening. It's so important in our representative democracy that all of us engage in the process and be a part of this. That is how we make a difference as a community moving forward. As you mentioned, I was born and raised in Santa Barbara. On my mother's side, we've been ranching in California for 3 generations. My father, who's here tonight, is a U.S. Army veteran and a doctor, uses medical expertise to create devices that help people live better lives. I grew up building this business with my family, from packing boxes, taking inventory, going to trade shows and the different chambers around the community. I built this business. I serve as vice president of that business today. A few years ago, I worked for a senior member of Congress. I worked on a handful of different issues, from foreign policy to agriculture, commerce, manufacturing, and trade, small business, a number of things that were a big part of my background. It was my job to work with folks to create policy, bring consensus, and move that policy forward. But it was there that I really saw all that's wrong with our political system today. We have, what many of you are concerned about, a tendency for political insiders to be more concerned about their next election than they are the policies that affect this and the next generation. We have the empty rhetoric with very little action. It's just as bad as you think. I resigned and began to take over our family's business, but I realized this, that if you don't get involved with the government that you have, you're going to get what you deserve. So it is necessary that all of us work with one another to elect, and I appreciated something that was said earlier, that the motto this year for your organization is shape the future. That's what I believe that this election is going to be for us moving forward on the Central Coast and for our nation. I look forward to continuing this discussion this evening. Thank you.
I'm sorry that we just really have to keep to the time frame because 2 hours is going to go by very quickly. Next to me, Mr. Salud Carbajal. He's a Democrat. Since 2004, he has been an elected member of Santa Barbara County Board of Supervisors. He served on President Obama's Committee on Climate Change.
Thank you, Shirley, and thank you to the American Association of University Women for tonight. I'm the youngest of seven. My father immigrated our family to the United States when I was 5 years old. First, we lived in Arizona, where he worked in an underground copper mine. When that closed, we moved to Oxnard, where my father worked as a farm worker. And despite long hours and long days of work, it was difficult to get ahead on minimum wage as a farm worker. We moved into public housing, and despite the economic hardships that our family endured in public housing, I was able to do well, and I attended UCSB. At UCSB, I met my wife on a blind date. Many people say she's still blind because she's still with me. We have two wonderful children. I joined the United States Marine Corps Reserve while I was at UCSB. I've had a number of administrative jobs in the health and human service sector. For the past 12 years, I've worked as the Santa Barbara County Supervisor, where I've worked in a bipartisan way with my colleagues to bring about solutions to the many challenges that our communities face. We have the highest rainy day reserve in the county's history. We have the highest bond credit rating in the state of California. We've balanced our budget each and every year. We've made a significant investment in our infrastructure for roads and parks. And while doing that in a bipartisan way, we've been able to make essential investments in making sure that we provide for our most vulnerable, making sure we provide health insurance for our children, making sure we work with our schools to keep our children in school. I want to go to Washington because I want to make sure that middle-class, hardworking families have the same opportunities I had growing up, to bring people out of poverty, to expand opportunities for the middle class, and to grow our economy so that more people can have opportunities. That's why I'm running for Congress.
Thank you. Okay, next we'll come up with Mr. Benjamin Lucas, and he is a Democrat. He says he's a Reagan Democrat. He's from Montecito, and he is the author of a publication entitled The Solution.
Hi, I am Benjamin Lucas, and I am a Reagan Democrat. I realize I'm in a Republican stronghold in Atascadero. I'm not naive. Tonight, I have only one intention, to have you vote for me after this evening. I'm here to earn that vote. I hope the questions are as intelligent as the people look in this audience. And I'm expecting a great forum this evening. I look forward to it. I hope the audience takes advantage of tapping my mind and asking me the questions. I'm here to answer them directly and forward and very specifically. I look forward to this forum tonight, and thank you for having me.
Thank you, Mr. Lucas. And then we have Mr. John Ubersax. He's an independent. He has lived in San Luis Obispo County since 2009 and is originally from Thousand Oaks. He's a former Cal Poly instructor. He currently directs Californians for Higher Education Reform and writes on tuition reform, modern society, war, and peace. Mr. Ubersax.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the organizers, my fellow candidates, and you.
All right, I'd like to thank the organizers, my fellow candidates, and the audience for participating. So two things set me apart from all the other candidates tonight. I'll tell you the second one later. But the first one is that I'm adamantly, staunchly, and firmly opposed to war. Not all war, but to the wars our country is in now. All six of them. Afghanistan, we started in 2001. Iraq, 2003. We've accomplished nothing. We've spent $6 trillion. We're all suffering because of this. Now, I'm not just a professional anti-war agitator. I'm a member of this community, which brings me to why I'm here tonight. I'm a member of this community. I look at each and every one of you as my friends and neighbors, and I care. And I believe that the thing I can do the best to help you is to work with you to relieve the burden that these wars are placing on our society, the economic burden and the moral burden. The burden that comes from fighting wars that are based on oil and dollars and profits, thinly disguised as humanitarian ventures. They're not doing anything. You don't help people by bombing their children. Now, the time has come when we have to stand up because only we, the citizens, can remove this burden. And I really believe that the thing I can do the best to help each and every one of you is to run so that you can vote against the war. And that simple action will change you. It will change history. It will change the world. To say no to this partisans, these specious arguments and false issues, to take a stand for peace and for the truth of the human heart. It's that simple. That's what I want to see you do. Please vote for peace.
Thank you, Mr. Ubersax. And then next we have Bill Ostrander. He is a Democrat. He's a sustainable farmer and director of a nonprofit and is a real estate developer.
Good evening. I know some of you because I live in San Luis Obispo, and thank you for having us all here tonight to hear our points of views. You know, one thing that occurs to me as I listen to all my colleagues up here is the one thing that hasn't been mentioned, and if you ask me and from my work, I can tell you that the single biggest thing that stands before us in having the legislative outcomes that we want, including equal pay for women, is money in politics. How many of you would agree with me on that? I can tell you that I've gone to Washington and I've spent time lobbying and advocating at 65 different offices of the House and Senate. And if you want to understand the legislative outcomes that we're getting, you need to follow the money. And tonight, through any of these questions, if you ask me, I'm pretty sure I can tell you how the money got us around to the legislative outcome that most of us do or do not want. So I'm a regenerative farmer. I live in San Luis Obispo. Regenerative farmer is somebody that tries to improve the soil. It's an important aspect of trying to create climate change or reverse climate change because it's one of the only places we have to sequester carbon. I also run a nonprofit called Citizens Congress, where we try to remove the corruptive influence of money in Washington. If you want to understand why this opening bit was so important, I want you to understand that Congress today only meets on average 137 days of the year. They work for 4.8 hours. And 4 hours of every day is spent across the street in the Republican or Democratic committee headquarters meeting rooms, dialing for dollars. So when you talk about the people that are up here and who they are, you have to understand that you have less than an 8% chance of getting a bill passed through Congress. So you better be really convinced that this is important. And who we are as individuals is what we're going to do when we get to Washington. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ostrander. Before we move into the questions from the audience, our Atascadero AAUW branch has a question to ask of all candidates on the issue of pay equity. AAUW on a national, state, and local level has worked for many years to address the issues of pay equity. I'll give a little bit of history and preface the question, and the question will be asked in alphabetical order. Pay equity is defined as eliminating sex and race discrimination in setting wages. Pay gap is defined as a percentage and is calculated by dividing the median annual earnings for women by the median annual earnings for men. National Pay Equity Day for 2016 will be on April 12th. The American Association of University Women, on a national level, began to address the needs for pay equity in 1922 with legislative programs to repeal salary restrictions in women's bureaus. Statistics presented here are given by the National Committee on Pay Equity that were put together by the National Women's Law Center and by AAUW. Not our local AAUW, but national research. The statistics show for the United States as a whole, the gender wage gap for full-time, year-round workers is 21.4%. The national statistics show an annual wage difference nationwide of $10,762, with men earning that much more than their female counterparts. Projected outwards, this difference results within the United States of a lifetime wage loss for women of $430,480 over a 40-year career. If you're a woman of color, the gap is even greater when compared with white, non-Hispanic males. Although California is a state with strong equal pay protections, according to AAUW research, California ranks 8th out of the 51 states with an earnings factor of 84%. That translates into women earning 84.1 cents for every dollar a man earns. California has a wage gap of $8,053, and women have a lifetime wage loss of $322,120. AAUW research further shows that District 24 ranks 38th out of the 53 state congressional districts. In District 24, women earn 80.3% of what men earn. There have been national attempts to establish pay equity. On June 10, 1963, President Kennedy signed the Equal Pay Act. President Obama signed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act on January 29, 2009, and yet statistics show that wage disparity continues in the United States. Recently, California has enacted and passed SB 358 to bring about pay equity in California. The question is, how do you see the new California Fair Pay Act impacting the wage gap? And what definitive actions would you take as our congressional representative to eliminate state and national wage gap in order to achieve pay equity? And we'll start with Mr. Asajjan. And you will have one minute to respond.
Thank you. I definitely support that. Just having my daughter college graduate, I want her to make as much money as any man who graduates at the same time, with the same degree, with the same experience. In my business, the highest paid person is a woman, happened to be manage my business. It's not related to me. My district person is, has happened to be a woman, who is the highest paid person in my entire, among my entire district staffers. So I leave what I say, and again, for a woman who has the same experience as a man, there is no reason that for her to be paid any less. Otherwise, there is that inequity. I think the time has come that we consider that seriously, and those who don't, the laws will be against them.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Asajjan. Mr. Salud Carbajal.
Thank you very much. I support the equity pay legislation that Senator Jackson passed here in the state of California. But we need to do a lot in Congress. We need to do four things. The first one is to make sure that we actually pass legislation that has penalties, that puts punitive sanctions for any employer who continues to discriminate. We need to make it more transparent so everybody knows what everybody gets paid. We need to make sure that we are making sure that we also put in penalties for retaliation. And lastly, so that it's effective, we need to make sure that we actually have labor audits so that companies know they're going to be audited to make sure that they're abiding by the law and they're not discriminating.
Thank you, Mr. Carvajal. Mr. Farid.
I, too, am very supportive of it. I believe in a merit-based system. I grew up where my mother was the CEO of our business, strong woman, worked hard. Still works hard. Most of my staff actually are women who have been excellent at doing what they do as well. I believe in a merit-based system. To me, that's not a matter of gender. It's how hard you work and the deliverables that you have on top of that. And I believe many people who want to succeed and excel will hire the best talent, and that is not gender-specific.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Farid. Mr. Steve Isaacson.
Thank you. Like everybody, I'm certain, at the table, we all support certainly equal pay for equal work and the legislation that's recently been passed as well. There's no question on that. How do you proceed in Congress to enact it? Some of Carbajal's suggestions are good. One thing they can do very strongly, though, is the federal government issues a lot of contracts to corporations. And at that time, with the award, surveys can be done at that time to assure those institutions are adhering to the law. Because this is law at this point, certainly in California. California issues them too. And contract award can be dependent upon following the law. And that needs to be enacted very strongly to ensure it. But I am glad to see that...
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Isaacson. Mr. Benjamin Lucas.
I hope you don't mind if I sit down. I think a two-hour night of standing and sitting, I think this might speed it up a little. My mother was the president of Junior Women's Club when I was a child. I grew up with an independent mother. That's why I'm a Reagan Democrat. My mom was Gloria Steinem, and my dad was Rush Limbaugh. So that's my childhood. Recycling programs in the 60s, I understand this. I think the best way is AAUW should understand this the best is education. You can't change anything without changing the mindset of the culture. I would start in elementary school, middle schools, the empowerment programs. I would start there. It's going to be a long process to get out of. Time is everything. Over time, it will change, but it starts with our youth. And I would start power programs for young ladies.
Okay, thank you. I got out of alphabetical order. Mr. Kokanen.
Thank you.
Send me back to kindergarten.
Thank you. I was born in Finland, as I said. Finland was the first country in the world to grant women the right to vote, so that's my heritage. More women are now graduating from medical schools than men, and my daughter being an MD, I'm well aware of that. I've been an employer for the last 40 plus years. I've hired lots of men, I've hired lots of women, and in my place we've never considered the sex or background or any other criteria except is the person qualified, and if they're qualified they get paid commensurately with that. I'm absolutely in favor of a merit-based system. We have laws in force right now which I think are address the issue. I'm not in favor of creating more and more laws to solve problems for which we have current laws. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. William Ostrander.
Thank you. I think the question had to do with what would we do in Congress if we were there, and I think that my apologies.
Would you like me to restate the question?
No, I think I heard it. I wanted to remind myself and maybe everyone else that I think what you ask is how would we do something different in Congress or bring that to Congress, because in fact, California has sort of led the way in this. They're ahead of many of the other states in the country. Even though we still are only 80% in this particular district,
California has sort of led the way, and some of the things that we need to do to encourage is more women in STEM occupations. We need to make sure that we cover all employees. We need to prohibit retaliation. We need to establish transparency. We need to clarify employee defenses so that people actually know, okay, these are the rules. So there's a few things like that that we can do. But much of the actual system that we do in California could be imported at the federal level. And, I want to applaud Mr. Ashajian for helping to pass that bill, by the way. And I think it's something that we can actually show the United States Congress what we do in California.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ostrander. I just got a note that said that when candidates don't stand, people past the first couple of rows can't see them. So for visibility purposes, it's probably better to stand. Okay. Moving on to Helene Snyder.
Well, thank you. And what a great question. And thank you for your leadership on this issue. I met Lilly Ledbetter when she was pushing the Lilly Ledbetter Act through Congress. And one of the things that you need to know about the issue is that you need to know that there is a problem. If you don't know and understand what your colleagues are making, you can't even tell if there's a pay equity or a pay gap at all. And that's part of what the California bill in particular, I think, is very strong. I'm very pleased to that Senator Jackson supporting my campaign, and this is one of the things I want to do, is move the what's happening here in California onto a national stage. So it's a couple of things. One, it's dealing with non-retaliation for asking about other people's pay. It's about allowing businesses to do the right thing and do audits and giving them the tools to learn how to do not only the pay gap issue, but learn about comparable work. And then also, finally, to have stiff penalties if a company purposefully evades the law as well. When I was in college, in my college year, and I'd love to tell you about that when we have more time.
Thank you. Okay. Moving on to John Ubersacks.
Thank you. What I'd like to take is a different perspective on this. Now, of course, there should be equal pay for equal work. But what concerns me more fundamentally is that in our society, we have a very deep problem, and that money has become the medium by which we evaluate every issue. So what I'm far more concerned about, money means nothing to me. What matters to me is moral equity. What matters to me is that a woman can grow up in our society with no constraints on her realizing her true nature and being everything that nature intends her to be, a complete human being. At the end of one's life, looking back and saying, I lived my life the right way. I wasn't held back. And in other words, a life based on love. If we were a more loving society, we would be more easily able to work out these problems. No one would dream of oppressing another person with wages. So what we have to concentrate is rebuilding that moral foundation, and the simplest way to begin is to end the greatest moral abuse, which is war.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ubersacks. I want to thank you all. You've just adhered to the time frame very nicely, and so we're moving right along. What I'd like to ask right now is, would you like to take a short break, or should we move into the questions from the audience?
No, let's do questions.
Okay. I've been given some questions as you were all talking. Okay, I am assuming, because this does not indicate it's toward a particular person, that it's toward the entire panel. And so you will each have 1 minute to state your views, and we will move from the opposite end of the table with Mr. Ostrander and move in this direction toward Mr. Coconut. The current situation with campaign financing is a mess. Please explain your impression of its current status and what you would do about it. How has your campaign been funded? Okay.
Well, that's a good one for me. We have 1 minute or 2 minutes here?
You have 1 minute.
1 minute. Okay. Really quickly. Gillens and Page are two political scientists that did a study on legislative outcomes from 1981 to 2002. And what they found out of 1,799 legislative outcomes was not that majoritarian democracy ruled the day, the thing that we're taught in our civics classes in schools, the things that we're supposed to be franchising to the rest of the world, the American brand, that is not what is dictating legislative outcomes. The single biggest determinant of legislative outcomes is money. It affects every single legislative outcome that comes down the pike, and it is exponentially growing with each particular election. We, at this point, are $300 million into dark money into this election, which is three times more than it was in 2012. It's frightening the amount of money that's flowing into this election. I'm the only candidate who signed the People's Pledge and the Democracy Pledge.
Thank you, Mr. Ostrander.
We need more than a minute on these.
I know, but we only have 2 hours. Okay, Mr. Rubisak.
I think that, well, first of all, I'm not accepting any contributions, and I'm running without any money, except for a few dollars that I put in. And this speaks to my response, and that is, we can't keep blaming the politicians for what is fundamentally our problem. The solution comes when we stop listening, we stop watching television ads. And then they'll have no incentive to collect the money, when we're not swayed by that. When we're intelligent voters, when we keep asking, what is your position on the issues? When we go to their websites, when we're a literate democracy, the money will have no meaning. And, of course, if we end war, the military-industrial complex will not be able to bribe our politicians and feather their campaign war chests.
Thank you, Mr. Ubersax. Okay, Mr. Lucas.
On campaign financing, I am self-funded. I anticipate to go all the way with my money. Mitchum ran a great campaign. He spent about $77,000, did very well against Lois Kapp. She spent $1,300,000. So you can really be efficient with your money in a local campaign. And for national campaigns, I would support caps. Everybody has to have the same amount of money to run. You limit it, and I think it should be government match funds. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lucas. Mr. Carvajal.
Thank you. My entire service, I have always been on record to be for campaign finance reform. I think Citizens United decision by the U.S. Supreme Court was a real travesty. But I think Congress can still do a lot to make sure we have transparency. For instance, passing the Disclose Act. That's one thing that can happen. We could do a lot more. And I will continue to, on day one, continue to advocate for campaign finance reform. I'm proud of the broad support that I received to date throughout the 24th Congressional District, and I am very proud to have gotten the endorsement of the most prominent campaign finance reform advocacy group in the nation, in Citizens United. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carvajal. Mr. Farid.
I think campaign finance is a significant issue because you need the financing to be able to get your message out to the voters that aren't people like you here in this room who are paying attention to the discourse, to the debate, to the discussion of the issues that matter to all of us here, that the candidates are going to advocate on behalf of. So it's a matter of being able to market and get that message out there to voters. Unfortunately, it's what many political insiders do with that money. If they're marketing or advertising deceptively and giving the wrong impression, that's a big problem. And the only way you could identify that is by being here in person and advocating on behalf of the candidate that you want to support. So it is incumbent upon all of us that if we're going to make a difference, go out and talk to as many people as you can and say, this is the candidate I'm supporting and why. That's how we make a difference and reform this structure.
Thank you. Ms. Snyder.
Thank you. It's an extreme serious issue. It's poisoning the well in Washington, D.C. And in fact, I think Mr. Ostrander has a lot of amazing great points, and I really appreciate that he's been focusing on this as well as he has. I, too, agree that ending Citizens United is necessary. That's a whole constitutional amendment. That's going to take a very long time. Transparency is extremely important. It's still the case that for Senate candidates, their campaign finance reports is a PDF that you can't, you know, easily download as an Excel sheet. Those kind of transparency issues are a problem. Super PACs are a problem. The amount of money going into political advertising, hundreds of thousands of dollars are going to be spent on this campaign by one or two candidates, and that is a problem. That is why I called for debates early and often. That is why it's important that we interact with each other on the issues so you have more than a minute even to talk to all of us at the same time on the issues so that you can make an informed vote as opposed to just talking about sound bites.
Thank you. Mr. Asadja.
Thank you. I say yes to campaign reform, and this year we had a couple of bills at the state level that push transparency forward, and I supported both of them. But the facts don't change yet. You need money. You need people to invest in your campaign to get your message out. And it's expensive. If it's paper advertising, TV advertising, radio advertising, to reach thousands of people within two counties, you need all that. You can knock on so many doors by yourself or by your volunteers, but it still needs that investment to get your message out. So it's a darn if you do it, darn if you don't. But I'm happy to say that entire amount of money that I've collected comes from the state. The vast majority, almost 80% of it, comes from the district itself. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Asadjan. Mr. Isaacson.
Yes, let's do in Citizen United. That's horrible. Super PACs need to be limited. And by the way, I'm self-funded. I'm sorry. We need to eliminate it. We do need to put a cap on the amount of campaign finances. One of the procedures I like recently is San Luis Obispo is starting up a method where I guess the city gives the public money and then the kind of a certificate, and then that money goes to candidates. That gives the public the right to give the money. If we also limit the amount that can be done, that can be done a lot. But it's going to come down to you to observe who are contributing to people and what obligations that sets on people. And I hate to say it, but it's in part on the voters, too.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Isaacson. Mr. Kokkonen.
It humors me a little bit here to find out, to listen to some candidates who are being financed greatly by, have huge amounts of money come in, and they talk about finance reform. I am not at all in favor of public financing of campaigns because that's not our taxpayers' problem. The candidates who are not in office have a very big problem in trying to catch the amount of money that the incumbents have. Even so, I'm not in favor of limiting the money at all for them. The incumbents have the ability to send out puff mailing pieces at no cost just during the campaign season. Unfortunately, we who are not incumbents, we have a heck of a lot more work to do. Most of my money has been, most of my financing has come from my own money, but I welcome your contributions.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm noticing that water pitchers are empty. I'm going to take a moment and collect them so that they can be refilled and put back on the table. Is that all right? The next question, you need to take a little stretch or anything. We will move on to the next question, and I will ask the question alphabetically from Z to A. So we will be starting with Mr. Ubersacks. What are your three top priorities for congressional action? How do you propose to act on your top priority? Mr. Ubersacks.
All right, the first priorities are ending war. That's okay, because we're not accomplishing anything. We're making terrorists. I need to tell you that I lived in Belgium, in Brussels, for 2 years. I took the metro through that stop that was bombed a couple of weeks ago every day. I saw the faces of the people. These are my friends who were blown up. Now, the sad news is that our country created ISIS. It's no secret about that. We've got to stop doing it. So my first action would be to pull the plug on the wars. The second action would be, conversely, to start peace. Because we're not going to be able to stop wars overnight, but we can make peace happen overnight. I'd institute a program where every year we'd spend $50 million giving some great monument of friendship to a foreign country. We'd start winning friends. It's that easy. That's a pittance. That's chump change. And the third would be I'd end the student loan program because it drives up tuition.
Thank you, Mr. Ubersax. Ms. Snyder.
Well, I think as what was talked about earlier, passing the Paycheck Fairness Act is of importance. And I think, as was mentioned before, what we've seen here in California, where actually it was practically unanimous in bringing forward both business and labor groups and women's groups together, we can do that on a national level as well. It's already been started. The student loan debt and being able to refinance federal student loans, I think, is a huge issue that really then leads to other things to help people, again, reach their full potential and make full opportunity. I also think it's about time, and we've been saying this on both sides of the aisle for decades, that it's time to deal with immigration reform. It is broken. It is hurting not only the people who are working. It's also hurting the farmers. It's hurting employers. It's hurting, and it's not helping law enforcement. It is a broken system, and it needs comprehensive reform, and only the federal government can do that, and it's past due.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Mr. Ostrander.
Thank you. Will turn it on. Thank you. I'm already working on campaign finance reform. The program that Mr. Isaacson talked about is the Democracy Voucher Program down in San Luis Obispo, which I co-authored with the Campaign Legal Center in Washington, D.C. Campaign finance reform is the single biggest impediment to us getting the legislative outcomes that we want. It is absolutely essential that we resolve this issue because it is the umbrella issue of all the issues, where money comes from and how it affects legislation. So that would be first. Second, I told you I'm a regenerative farmer. I understand how we can put carbon back in the soil. We need to do that. We can use our farm bill to change our farm policies to actually sequester carbon in the soil because we know we have too much in the air and we know we have too much in the water. Putting it back in the soil is one place they can actually go. And we need to reform our post-secondary education system. We have $1.3 trillion worth of debt and students are graduating with $35,000 worth of debt when we know that in $1 of post-secondary education investment by the public returns 700% back into the local economy.
Thank you, Mr. Ostrander. Mr. Lucas.
This is very hard to do in 1 minute. Mine are energy, education, and also immigration in this region. Those are our most important parts. Our natural resources here in District 24 are our most important problem in Washington. We have to take care of water, electricity. We pay 35% more than anybody else in the whole country for electricity, and we're right beside the only profitable nuclear plant in the country. And so this is what we're dealing with. If we take any more time with changing this, we won't be able to live here, not only because of the housing problem, but the energy problems, immigration. We have to reform that. Okay, and education, I hope we get in depth on all these subjects. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Kokkonen.
Number one, stop the illegal invasion. Why do illegals get benefits that our citizens have to pay for? Number two, fight radical Islam. Why should we lose our freedom of speech and freedom of religion to jihadist murderers? Three, stop borrowing money. Why should our children and grandchildren have to pay off our $19 trillion immoral debt? Number four, eliminate Common Core. Why should our children's education be a social experiment instead of education? Number five, stop funding sanctuary cities and states. Why does our government harbor illegal activities? Number six, why do we feed Delta DART with water instead of sending the water to our farmers and for food? Number six, follow the Constitution. What is your moral compass except for natural law and God-given rights to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness?
Thank you, Mr. Kokkonen. Mr. Isaacson.
Well, number one would be to move towards a balanced budget, at least over an economic cycle. If need be, since Congress has been bugged by this for decades and they seem unwilling, I would encourage a convention of states, if need be, to achieve it. It's extremely important. Second, for this district, I would be extremely interested in developing its green energy. It has lots of it out east of us within these counties. And the other one I think that's probably greatest is student debt. We put too many restrictions on student loans. Student loans do some very nice things to help students go to college, but we've restricted their usage too much, and it needs to be reformed. And campaign finance reform as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Isaacson. Let's see. Next would be Mr. Farid.
Well, first and foremost, we got to get Congress working again for the American people. One of the most main basic functions of Congress is the oversight, management, and allocation of taxpayer dollars. In the last 42 years, since they implemented the current budget structure in Congress, they have only passed a budget and appropriated taxpayer dollars on time once. So what ends up happening for the money that the Congress is responsible for is it's basically run an autopilot from the previous year. So you're not actually getting a real idea of how taxpayer dollars are being spent, whether they're yielding a return on their investment, whether it's actually working or not working, and you can't separate the bad from the good. We need to have 21st century policies implemented today. That's why I would move to a biennial budget, a two-year budget system, which is what you have here in Atascadero, one of the most solvent and well-run governments in San Luis Obispo. We need to have that at the federal level. There's only over 20 states that are on a biennial budgeting system and provide better oversight and management and actually allow us to return that investment on things like infrastructure and water here in California. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farid. Mr. Carvajal.
Thank you. My priorities would be in line with the values of the Central Coast, what middle-class working families here on the Central Coast want. That's raising minimum wage, expanding family leave, universal preschool, making sure we're expanding affordability and accessibility of higher education, making sure we're addressing climate change, immigration reform, that we're bringing about good jobs by investing in our infrastructure and investing in renewable energy sectors so that we could, one, protect our environment, and two, create well-paid jobs. That's what we need to do, and those are the three priorities that are important to me.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carvajal. Mr. Asadjan.
My priorities will start with the economy and creating jobs. Economy and jobs. We need to be more careful, the different countries that we have trade agreements with. We need not to have trade agreements with those countries who have different policies and different standards of living than we do. We need to treat their products the same way they treat ours. We need to make America competitive again. We need to have jobs that are good-paying jobs, high-paying jobs. Our students coming out of college, doing their best, we need to have jobs available for them. National security is another one. We want to be sure that our borders are secure and safe from terrorists who come here. We want to be sure that what happened in Europe never takes place in the United States. Immigration is another issue. Our farmers are short-handed. We need to be sure that we bring back something like Bracero program back and work permit. More time?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Asadjan. And before we go to the next question, we'll get you back your water pitchers.
May I ask a question?
Yeah.
If there are many more of these type of questions, is it possible that we can extend that time to 90 seconds instead of a minute? I feel like most of us are up here trying to spit something out as quickly as we can, and I'm not actually able to address some of the really important parts of that issue. What do you think? I'd rather take one or two less questions and give you complete answers than spit stuff out. That would be my opinion, but it's up to your group.
Well, so what does the panel think?
I would support that. I only got to one point on the top three priorities. So.
Yeah,
certainly, I would say, do what you want to do. What does the crowd want?
All right. Okay, we're going to go on. Okay, we're going to go on as it is, and then and see where we can what we can get through. The next question is on health care. Do you favor repeal for the Affordable Care Act? If so, what, if anything, do you think should replace it? Be specific. And we'll start with Mr. Kokanen and move on down the table.
Well, we definitely need to get rid of the law that was passed by absolute lies by our president. Keep your doctor if you don't like it. Keep your insurance if you like it. Keep your insurance. And your premiums, have they gone down $2,500? Heck no. I've been dealing with medical insurance with our clients for the last 40 years, actually. I have a very good understanding of what's happening on that issue. My daughter's a doctor also. We absolutely have to change it, get rid of it. The question is how to deal with the uninsurables. That premium increase for that is approximately 20%, give a plus or minus some. One way to make it possible is to eliminate the restrictions on buying insurance across state lines. But we have to make sure that we also get rid of the requirement that you can basically only get a tax deduction if you work for a company. That health insurance needs to be the tax credits given to individuals.
Thank you, Mr. Kokkonen. Okay, Mr. Isaacson?
No, I do not want to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. While it's not being fully implemented right now, and the numbers have not greatly gone down. In the long run, the number of uninsured will go down, and for that reason, I want to keep it. However, what I'm not for as part of that law is it's not affordable. The costs are way higher than predicted. There are things that can be done about some of the costs, some being able to buy drugs in elsewhere, whether it be from Canada or even other states to some extent, and buying insurance across state lines would drop down the cost. Right now, the insurance agencies have a captive audience. We have to buy the insurance, so to speak. And so they're going to remain up in costs, and I see the stop sign about to come up.
Thank you, Mr. Isaacson. Mr. Arasajan.
Thank you. When the president came on public TV and said, "You may keep what you have if you like it. Otherwise, we have something else to offer to you," that wasn't the case. So obviously that meant that there was something wrong with what was coming our way. To have least amount of payment for insurance, we need to bring more insurance companies to do business with us. Bring competition. Just like anytime you turn the TV on, there is advertising for car insurances, but hardly any for health insurance. We need to be able to buy insurance where available to the best of our expectation, and give us tax incentives to buy insurance to ourselves for our employees. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sajjan. Ms. Schneider.
I would not vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act is not perfect, but it's certainly better than what we had before with millions of Americans uninsured, actually costing taxpayers more money in emergency care services. There are issues that need to be addressed. I think it was mentioned earlier about prescription drug regulations. There's got to be a better way to negotiate with prescription with the pharmaceutical industry in reducing the cost of prescription drugs. The issue of money in politics comes right into this as well. The insurance companies have a hold on many members of Congress, and there should not be a way that insurance companies can make so much money off the backs of families and on based on their need to have a healthy life and to get good services. Those kind of restrictions must be addressed further as well.
Thank you. Mr. Farid.
I would vote to repeal and replace Obamacare with market-based solutions that allow for competition across state lines to drive down costs, present more options for us as the consumer. I think there are many solutions that we could do and implement, like allowing small businesses to pool their resources. Again, that would allow more accessibility but keep the cost low and manageable. What we saw with the passage of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare was exactly what is wrong with Congress systemically. It did not have proper markup in the House or congressional participation, and that's when you heard Nancy Pelosi stand up and say, "Let's pass this to find out what's in it." We need to have better congressional participation and bipartisan support of a legislation before it gets passed into law. And if you try to change one thing about the Affordable Care Act through Congress, it will affect the entire other side of it, and that's why it needs to be repealed and brought back before Congress to get the due diligence it deserved the first time around. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farid. Mr. Carvajal.
Thank you very much. I would not vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act certainly is not perfect. We need to address the Cadillac tax. We need to make sure that Medicare is able to do what the VA does and use their procurement power to negotiate better rates with the pharmaceutical companies and pass those on to seniors. We need to make sure that we address the insurance grip on our healthcare system to make sure that doesn't continue. And that's as part of why inflation of costs has continued to go up. We need to bring down costs, no doubt. But I will tell you, this is one issue that I and my Republican opponents here on this dais have a significant difference. Who can deny that the Affordable Care Act has brought insurance to thousands and millions of Americans, families and individuals who didn't have insurance before, individuals who had pre-existing illnesses who now have access to health care? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Carbo. Mr. Lucas.
I will disagree with Mr. Carbajal on that subject. I think the innate flaw in Obamacare is that it doesn't reach the people it really needs. You can insure everybody, but if there's no hospital that accepts it in Santa Barbara, Cottage, Samson, they have high deductibles, poor people, inner city people, rural communities, they don't even have hospitals to go to. I would support having, if you graduate college with your own volition and get into a medical school, I would offer the government to pay your medical school anywhere you've been accepted. You give 5-year service to community, paid service in rural community hospitals and inner city hospitals. You learn humility as a doctor. You come out a better doctor, and the inner city and rural communities receive service with no charge.
Thank you. Mr. Ubersax.
I've been in the health field for 25 years. I've been a professor of public health at a medical school. I've worked at the RAND Corporation as a health policy analyst. I know this field inside and out. We've been thinking about it for a long time. I'm here to tell you that what's going on right now is a classic case of what's wrong with this country, divide and conquer. We've got two parties fighting about fundamentally a flawed system. The answer is preventive health care. If every one of us were to walk 30 minutes a day, we'd cut the health care costs of this country in half. But nobody talks about it because there's no profits to be made in prevention. They want to sell you expensive medicines, make you sick with side effects, and then give you more medicine. That's the problem.
Thank you, Mr. Ubersack. Mr. Ostrander.
Thank you. You know, what we really should be talking about, the primary level issue here, is health care a right or a privilege? Is it a right or a privilege? If we must pay taxes, if we can be forced to go to jail, if we can be forced to give up our life in war, don't we also have a certain amount of responsibility for an individual's health? I believe we do. The other day I was precinct walking down a Goleta and I met a 23-year-old young man with an autoimmune disease. He said, I'm scared to death of the next president being a conservative who's going to come in and try to repeal the Affordable Care Act because I will die. 17 million people got affordable care because of the Affordable Care Act, and 27 million more should get it were it not for the fact that many of my conservative friends' governors have rejected Medicare and Affordable Care Act for their states. So I'm sorry, but it is not, you guys have amnesia. This was created by a conservative government. The Massachusetts actually created this program under Romney. Oh, I wish I could talk about this more.
Thank you, Mr. Ostrander. Thank you.
And I really should have a debate about this.
The next question, we will be going back to going A through Z. So we'll be starting with Mr. Asajjan. Philip 66 is proposing 3 580-car oil trains carrying Alberta tar sands with the same flash point as gasoline. What is your position, Mr. Asajjan?
That's a very local position to be held. What I would do, if I was a member of the local board of supervisors, I would pay attention to the environmental impact report and to see what the study comes up with to tell me what is negotiable, what is undoable, what the fears are, and address the issues one at a time if they're addressable. Otherwise, it's a problem. So it's, and I firmly believe empowering local government, and it's a local government issue.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Asajjan. Next will be Mr. Carbajal.
Thank you very much. I am very much against Phillips 66 project. I think it has the potential for a serious disaster. I live in Santa Barbara County. You've all heard the Refugio spill. The Phillips 66 project is a disaster waiting to happen, the trifecta to our environment, to our economy, and to our safety. I'm proud that I brought this issue to our Board of Supervisors to take a position against this project because of the real danger it poses along the Central Coast. It is a real threat to our lives, it's a real threat to our environment, and it's a real threat to our economy that depends on so much of our livelihood off our coast. I'm against this Phillips 66 project.
Thank you, Mr. Carvajal. Mr. Farid.
Well, this is a local issue, but I think we could take an opportunity to talk about, you mentioned the Refugio oil spill, which was a federal issue because that pipeline was regulated by the Department of Transportation in Washington, D.C. I think this begs the question, is centralized governing in Washington, D.C. the best entity, or is the Department of Transportation the best entity to have oversight of what's happening in Santa Barbara County? I think we got to answer that question. Secondly, when we're talking about investing so many taxpayer dollars in this bureaucracy, when we have an issue like we had right there, I've talked to many people, even your colleagues, Supervisor, who had mentioned that there were people on the ground and ready to stop the spill as it was going into the ocean, but they had to stop because of the different agencies that they had to deal with regard to that. We need to have a more efficient system than we have currently in place, and that's not going to happen through this current system. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farid. Mr. Isaacson.
The Phillips 66 project, I think, should be ended, to be honest. It creates some health hazards, even with the reduced system in the immediate vicinity of where they're offloading the trains. They could improve it just by moving the offload point further away from all population centers. But beyond that, the lawyers came back and I basically, as I read, told the local council, you can't be concerned about the actual transportation up to that point, because that's a Department of Commerce, federal. Well, we're running for Congress. That gives us some authority there with the Department of Commerce about whether it's legitimate to continue. And a spill, as it's occurred in many places of the country, has caused real disasters in some towns of a train that size. They're better off still trucking it in than a train load of something that volatile. Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you, Mr. Isaacson. Mr. Kokkonen.
Behind the question is desire by a lot of people to avoid or to get rid of all types of oil, because people, many environmentalists, think that that is a source of all evil for mankind. And I don't think there are many people here who came walking. We must realize that we need oil for everything in our society. Not only gas or for running cars. I am in favor of continuing with the project. It's much better to do on by train than any other way. Specifically on oil, and the channel, Santa Barbara Channel, is the largest seep area, natural seepage of oil in the second largest in the world. And the best way to get rid of the pressure and to help our environment is to pump it out. Just like if you have a septic tank that's overflowing, you reduce the pressure, and by doing that, you eliminate the problem.
Thank you, Mr. Kokkonen. Mr. Lucas.
I'm actually in favor of the Keystone Pipeline. If Canada is trying to get that oil down here, I feel that we should try to find a compromise. If we can bring oil down from Canada all the way to New Orleans, we can bring water from Lake Superior to Lake Mead and feed California, Arizona, and New Mexico. And I would propose that we have them at the same time. It's always as cheap to build two as one if you develop. They build a pipeline across the Transcontinental Highway, 4 feet. There's already one coming from Lake Superior into lower Arizona. Arizona, it's up online, $1 a gallon. Largest source of water we have are the Great Lakes. They're not going to run out till the end. Everybody runs out. Have them build it across and give them a compromise. We get water. They get to bring their oil down, and we all work together in North America. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ostrander.
Well, I absolutely oppose the oil trains. Nobody here is talking about the externalized cost that comes along with all this fossil fuel production. The fact of the matter is that just if you look at the oil train delivery system itself, it comes down to Cuesta Grade, which is regarded as one of the five worst sections of track in California. So not only do we have a disaster, a potential disaster, of which we do not have the emergency resources in which to handle, we are continuing to invest in a fossil fuel structure. And we actually have to learn to start weaning ourselves of this. And this is one of the ways in which we can do that. So not only is it a bad idea for us locally because of the safety concerns, it's continuing to invest in a fossil fuel which is 19th century, 20th century technology, which has externalized costs, which we're not talking about here today, unfortunately, and we need to. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Snyder.
I brought this issue to the Santa Barbara City Council in opposition of the project and took the time to speak at the San Luis Obispo Planning Commission hearing, the first time they had the hearing with hundreds of other people there spending all day at the hearing. I oppose this project, and I think even though the rail spur part of it itself is a local project, it does have national implications, and there's issues related to national policy that relate to it. The Department of Commerce issues are already mentioned. The federal transportation rail safety programs is a big part of it as well. The Department of Transportation and the U.S. government oversees that part of our national freight rail. Over a year ago, I sent a letter to Secretary Fox about ways that we can, as local governments, work together on increasing that. But it's really Congress that sets the budget. And then finally, as Mr. Ostrander was saying, we need to figure out how we can incentivize and promote other forms of green and clean renewable energy sources, and that is a Congress budgetary issue as well.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Mr. Ubersex.
I don't have anything to add to what Mr. Carbajal and Mr. Ostrander said. I'm completely opposed to the oil trains. They've blown up. There have been disasters. They're an accident waiting to happen. And what's the benefit? Six or seven jobs, and as far as I know, this oil is headed for China anyway. So what's the point, really? And I totally support the rights of localities not to be trumped by federal regulations on this. It's our right to say no to these trains, and I'll strap myself to the track if we have to.
Thank you, Mr. Ubersax. The next question, we will be going from Mr. Ostrander down to this side of the table. The question is, how would you facilitate pre-K for all of children? And it says in San Luis Obispo County, but I would like to add for District 24.
Well, we have defunded education as a whole over this country since 1980 by 40%, particularly in post-secondary education. Education happens to be one of those particular items in our state budgets we actually have discretionary power over. And we tend to find that over time, that whenever we have a recession, we have a restriction or reduction in our revenues at the state level, we tend to start cutting those corners, and usually it's in education, which I think is a mistake. So actually, I think that we should be looking at funding preschool education, because we know, we see how preschool education advances children's learning. It advances them. They earn more money throughout their lives. They are more well-developed people, and it's an enormous contribution to our community as a whole. So it should be funded. Now, the question is whether it should be funded individually at state levels or whether it should be at the federal level. I'm not entirely sure. I think there probably has to be a combination of those items. But it's clear that it's a solid investment in healthier communities and healthier children.
Thank you, Mr. Ostrander. Mr. Ubersex.
Could you repeat the question? I didn't quite catch it.
I sure will. How would you facilitate pre-K, that's pre-kindergarten, for all children in San Luis Obispo County, and I would add in District 24.
Okay, what I'd think about is something like a voucher system. I think there are a lot of nice people struggling to run their private daycare centers, and I think they probably ultimately will do a better job than incorporating this into our public school system, which I hear nothing but complaints about. So I'd work for a voucher system and to even try to expand that up through the elementary school ages as well.
Thank you. Mr. Lucas.
I really believe in pre-education, and I had mentioned earlier about educating women and empowering young girls. That would also be included in pre-K. You learn most of your life by the time you're four, it said, and that your personality strongly develops, and then as the rest goes, your education continues. I believe that I would be an open conduit to this industry that has established itself and make sure funding is available for those things. I really don't think it's a federal issue. It's more a state and local. But I'd make sure funding's available, and I'd be an open ear to hear the people that are running those programs.
Thank you. Mr. Carvajal.
Thank you very much. Just this week, I visited a preschool Head Start program with Congresswoman Lois Capps, who has also endorsed my campaign. I can tell you that children's brains, 80% of their brains are developed between 1 and 3 years old. How I would do it is I would work in a bipartisan way with my colleagues in Washington to make sure that we're reforming our tax code so that billionaires and multinational corporations are paying their fair share of taxes, so that then we could reinvest that money into universal preschool throughout our country. That's what I would do.
Thank you, Mr. Carvajal. Mr. Farid?
I believe education needs to be local. It's got to be accountable to the parents, to the teachers, and the people at the local level. So that's how I would keep that. I do believe that pre-education is important. I'm fortunate to have spent my pre-education working with my family and growing up doing that. I think we all need to have that type of involvement, although it is very difficult with so many hardworking families to be able to spend that time with their kids at that age. I was speaking with someone earlier today at a donut shop who was working two different jobs. His wife has started a temp job and was getting paid $15 an hour. And she, the aggregate total of what it cost to go to daycare was almost $900 a month, and therefore she decided not to take that temp job at $15 an hour and stay at home with the kids because it didn't make economic sense. So this is something that is important.
Thank you, Mr. Farid. Ms. Snyder?
Certainly pre-K education is a cornerstone of investing in our future. It's the first place to go, and it shouldn't be seen as a cost but as an investment for our next generation to be adults who are able to fully move into our society. There has to be ways to incentivize teachers to give them enough pay and benefits so they can actually do the job. And because I don't think our teachers are well compensated well in a way, especially in pre-K issues. There has to be an availability perhaps through the federal government in partnership with state and local agencies on incentivizing another way to reduce student loan debt, maybe going back into the AmeriCorps program is a great example of being able to come back into communities and be part of the teaching universe and trying, especially focusing on pre-K.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Mr. Asadja.
Thank you. Children of that age, they're one-third of our population, but all of our future. And how dare we not invest in their future? If we want to have better, brighter future, we better invest in our children's education. And that's a very important age, because at that age, their brains are such a sponge that everything we teach them, they will absorb it. We better invest in that age if we want to have a better future for all of us. Education is the key to their success. Education is the key to success for us all. Thank you. Where would I be without education?
Thank you, Mr. Asadjan. Mr. Isaacson.
Education in general is important, but pre-K education is also very important for the development of the child, and it's been proven over and over again it helps the child develop properly. My sister-in-law is a Head Start teacher. She and how Head Start works is it is controlled locally. A lot of decisions are made locally because the people here understand the thing. However, the local groups are state-funded. The state has a certain amount. But where does the money come from? Washington, for it. They have their rules. But ultimately, the education of the students is local, and that's a good model. I think it should be expanded so that more children can participate in preschool. And the voucher program is not that bad as well, since there are a lot of private daycares in the, not daycares, but preschools.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Isaacson. Mr. Kokkonen.
I'll refer again to my background in being from Finland, which is considered to have one of the best and highest educated populations in the world. And their school system is looked upon as a model for teaching. I do not believe that the federal government has any business being involved in education. As far as I'm concerned, the Department of Education in Washington should be disbanded. Everybody has been talking about funding and more. Let's be honest, who's going to pay for that? It's easy for everybody to promise, I'll do this, I'll do that. At the same time, where does the money come from? The responsibility lies with families. And one of the problems we have with education is the breakdown of a family unit of a father and a mother, which gives the stability for a good society. That's where a lot of the education must come from for, you know, for early childhood as well. The federal dollars should not be part of that, because if the federal government controls your education, that's bad, because with that go all kinds of restrictions.
Thank you, Mr. Kokkonen. Our next question has to do with climate change, and we are back to going from Z to A. So the question is, the Obama administration pledged to cut greenhouse gas emissions in the recent Paris meeting. As a way of meeting this pledge, the EPA has issued a clean power plan requiring existing power plants to reduce greenhouse gases. Do you support or oppose this plan? And we will start with Mr. Ubersacks.
Yeah, I support that plan absolutely. I don't think there's any scientific doubt in my mind, and hopefully most of yours, that global warming is a reality. I think that's the right track. We need to get the power plants to cut down their emissions. I'm just a little skeptical of the federal government's agenda, though, because just like when they tell us they're going to fight a war for humanitarian reasons, they sneak in a lot of tricks in there. The same things, they'll use this greenhouse, the global warming, as an opportunity to make profits for a lot of corporations. We need to be wary. But one way or the other, we need to act quickly, because if we don't, we're going to be facing some very serious issues. But one way or the other, we'll be acting.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ubersack. Ms. Snyder.
I do support this plan, and in fact, as mayors signed on to the U.S. Compact of Mayors in relation to the Paris talks, this is a great example of how mayors get things done in terms of looking at greenhouse gas emissions and being sustainable and using what we see from city to city as models of what can happen on a federal level. In the city of Santa Barbara, for example, we took our wastewater treatment plant and got a fuel cell in there that is converting the methane gas that comes from all of us, as well as the fats, oils, and grease that from restaurants, converting it from the methane gas into electricity, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and powering the plant. That's just one example of many. And the other thing is, as a city, we've been able to monitor and measure our greenhouse gas emissions. The recent President Obama's recommendations on climate resiliency is something we've looked at ourselves of what we've been able to do, where the gaps are, and we've been moving forward on a number of those initiatives. And again, this is where the incentives can come from mayors working forward on a national level.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Mr. Ostrander.
Thank you. First of all, yes, of course, I agree with that pact, and I'm glad that Mayor Schneider has endorsed that for the city of Santa Barbara. That's terrific. I am the only candidate in the country who's actually received an endorsement from the Carbon Underground for my work in regenerative farming and my paper that is actually published and has been tweeted out by Michael Pollan, if many of you know Michael Pollan, and who writes about food systems. There are three banks for carbon in this world. There's the atmosphere, there's the oceans, and there's the soil. The fact of the matter is that the soils are the one of those three banks which is actually depleted of carbon. And the fact is, by putting carbon back in those soils, which we can do as farmers,
we actually increase the fertility of that soil and its water holding capacity. So absolutely do I agree with that, but with the question about the President Obama's coal, but I also think that there's many things that we can do here in our own room and in our professions as individuals as well. And I specifically ask you to go to my website and take a look at that paper on agriculture's role in climate change.
Thank you, Mr. Ostrander. Okay, Mr. Lucas.
We're all quite aware that coal fire plants are really producing our CO2. California, our state, is naive to where we're really getting our power. We're getting over 5,000 megawatts from Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah. Five of the worst polluting plants in the country. One has been almost shut down by the EPA. They're under a rule right now down in New Mexico. Reid Gardner in Nevada produces 3,500 pounds per megawatt hour. We're pulling our power from there. We're so power depleted in California, it's ridiculous. And we're pulling all our power from coal. You might think it's alternative. You might think it's San Luis. Edison owns 46% of the plant in New Mexico. We're polluting as bad as any other state. Coal fire has to be stopped. China especially, they're building 8 plants a month. Has to be international rule, not just ours.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Kokanen.
Behind the climate change debate is man responsible for the climate change? The discussion used to be called global warming until they realized that this hockey stick issue of all of a sudden the globe becoming warmer actually was based on a lie. So they changed the debate to climate change. Climate change occurs everywhere. It's such a nebulous concept. At issue is... does man, to what degree does man create the climate change? We've had change in our climate for as long as we've been around, and we'll continue to have that. All you have to do is look at the record from all sources. I believe that that China is one of the countries that is not or has been given a buy on all of these discussions. And as long as there are specified countries that have a favored status, we will be lose on that account.
Thank you, Mr. Kokanen. Mr. Isaacson.
Yes, I believe in climate change. Yes, I believe man has accelerated climate change. And yes, I agree with Obama's mandate. One of the things that concerns me that's coming up is 20% of the energy that PG&E uses comes from Diablo Canyon. I don't know when, whether it'll be 6 years from now or 26 years from now. Diablo Canyon will be shut down because there's a wear-out mechanism in nuclear power plants, so it has to go. What are we going to replace it with? If nothing happens, it will be replaced with some form of fossil fuel-powered plant from some layers across the state or interstate. We need to develop the renewable resources and how to store energy. Those are programs being worked on at various places, okay. And we need to continue that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Isaacson. Mr. Farid.
I want to be an energy independent country. There is a demand in this country, but we also need to be conscious of the environment. We have the best technology. We are leaders in this world with the proprietary technology, the efficiency with which we use energy, and I believe that we should continue to be leaders around the world in that regard. I just met with a business just last week down in Goleta that has come up with a bunch of innovative techniques with LED bulbs that use a fractional amount of energy and it lasts twice as long. These types of things, with an all of the above approach, will lead towards a future in this country and hopefully around the world that is really driven by the private sector. To have a more sustainable, decarbonized future while allowing us to make sure that we get the demands that we need with the energy we have to have.
Thank you, Mr. Farid. Mr. Carvajal.
Thank you very much. I very much support the power plant rule. And I'm very proud to share with you that I'm the only one endorsed by the Sierra Club. I served on the President's Task Force on Climate Change. I've worked with my colleagues on the Santa Barbara County Board of Supervisors to move community choice energy forward, along with San Luis Obispo County and Ventura counties. We passed a climate change action plan in Santa Barbara County. And we've approved projects, solar projects, like the Cuyama Solar Facility that we recently approved. We need to do a lot more to divest ourselves from fossil fuels. And this is yet another example where my Republican opponents on this dais continue to have their head in the sand. They refuse to accept that there is global warming and that it's man-made. It's about time we start believing 99% of the scientific community that inform us that global warming is happening, that many things are happening.
Thank you, Mr. Carvajal. Mr. Asajan.
Thank you. Regardless of your beliefs if there is global warming or not, I'm glad that it's been talked about nationally and internationally, because for the previous past years, it was only talked about it in California, and California was to bear the burden of solving the global problem, which created a problem for us that took California out of the edge of competition. Businesses start moving out of state, and we lost a lot of jobs, and we got where we were 5 years ago. I'm glad that now it's taken given attention internationally, nationally, so that we're better off dealing with it, something considered global. That way we give it, it will give us back the edge to get our businesses going where entire world is treated the same way.
Thank you, Mr. Asajan. Our next question, we are back to going from Mr. Kokanen on down the table.
Why don't you start in the middle somehow?
Start in the middle? I could do that. But for right now, we're going to go down this way. If elected, will you sign the No New Taxes oath? Why or why not? Mr. Kokanen.
I have already stated that I will not. I'm not in favor of any new taxes. We are spending ourselves into destruction and perdition. Basically, the future of our grandchildren economically is much worse than what it is, what it has been for our generation. As a financial planner, I'm very, very concerned about the future. And the solution is not in increasing our taxes, but in having the government spend less. The problem with the government is not that they don't have enough money. They spend too much. Approximately, well, our deficit every year is growing almost by $1 trillion a year, which we're borrowing from somebody else. The only way the governments have been able to pay off their debts in the past is by shortchanging the people, because they inflate the dollar. So the dollar is cheaper. That's how they paid off. But that is stealing it from your from the future.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Mr. Isaacson.
Well, this may be unpopular, but no, I would not sign the pledge. Not that any of you probably have anything to fear from that. Our budget is not balanced, and our tax system is totally unbalanced. Virtually everybody here, if anything, I would reduce your taxes, but there are others that do not pay their fair share. There are tricks they pull, accounting schemes to reduce the amount they pay. I would want to modify that so they start paying their fair share. There are certain targeted taxes that are likely to be to pay for particular programs, probably from the very rich. There are other schemes that will allow them to the rich to pay more. Thank you.
Mr. Isaacson. Mr. Asajan.
I learned that you signed a pledge, you later on you kept out of any negotiations. As a small businessman, I feel the pain of overtaxation and overregulations. Taxes are not the answer. For us to maintain more tax, we need not to get deeper in your pocket. We need to create jobs, good-paying, higher-paying jobs. We need to increase the basis for taxes. Then we won't have any problems. I think that's the answer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Asajan. Ms. Schneider.
The federal budget is a very complex issue, and for just to say no new taxes or taxes, I think, is too simplistic. We had a former president who said, read my lips, look where that got him. That didn't do him very well at all. So, you know, the real issue is what can we do with our budget that reduces the amount of loopholes that big corporations get? Why are they being able to ship jobs overseas and still get tax breaks because of it? There are ways to reallocate the taxes that are happening in terms of everyone paying their fair share, so that you can pay for the items, and if there is a need for a new tax, you should have that as part of the bigger negotiating topic. So to sign a pledge one way or another, I think, dilutes your negotiation and your ability to reach across the aisle on a number of things. So no, I would not sign that pledge.
Thank you, Mrs. Snyder. Mr. Farid.
I've spent a great deal of time traveling all over the Central Coast and listening to voters, listening to their concerns. I hear so many frustrations with the direction that we're heading in, and their frustrations with the people in government that aren't doing anything to improve it. The federal government has a spending problem. The federal government spent $1.2 trillion in deficit spending this year. That's because this budget process is not effective. They have not passed a budget, as I mentioned earlier, and appropriated taxpayer dollars on time once. What we need to do is reform that budget structure, ensure that where taxpayer dollars are being spent are actually yielding a return, that they're making a difference, that we separate the bad from the good, and we cut the fat and the waste out of the federal government, that we modernize and bring up 21st century policies that allow us to be more in line with our national priorities today rather than the policies that existed 20 years or 30 years ago. We need to think about long-range solutions to these spending problems so that people are able to keep more of their own money in their pocket at the end of each month.
Thank you, Mr. Farid. Mr. Carvajal.
Our debt is almost $19 trillion. And instead of the bickering and gridlock that goes on in Washington, we need to roll up our sleeves in a bipartisan fashion once and for all and start trying to solve this problem. Reforming our tax code should not be a partisan issue. We should be able to work together, like it's been done in the past, to come about with tax reform so that corporations and billionaires pay their fair share of taxes. It's a shame that many of these multinational corporations pay less taxes than a middle-class family. We need to work to incentivize those corporations who are sending those employees overseas to not do that and penalize them. And at the same time, give them incentives to be able to repatriate all that money that they have in offshore accounts out of our country. We need to be able to find ways to work together and reform our tax code in a bipartisan way, in a way that brings prosperity to all us Americans.
Thank you, Mr. Carvajal. Mr. Lucas.
I think reforming our tax code almost sounds like an impossible task. My preference would be a consumer good flat tax on consumer goods, eliminate personal income tax and have a business and corporate flat tax. But I would really be for supporting that for consumer goods. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lucas. Mr. Ubersack.
I agree with what the last two gentlemen said. I think a corporate flat tax is a win-win situation. It will eliminate corporate cheating and will also be an incentive for the corporations to bring their dollars back home and not move overseas where they can take advantage of better tax breaks. But most of all, I want to say what I think is the issue here is taxes are just a drop in the bucket. I'm speaking particularly to the young people. We're all under a mountain of debt. Young people today have an impossible mountain, a burden of debt to face. They can't afford a house. In Morro Bay, a house costs $1 million. It's debt that's the problem. The tax is just a little bit. We have to reform our society based on values that are not monetary. We have to concentrate on building a high quality of life. Build more parks, museums, cultural opportunities. You don't get happy with money. Take money out of the equation. Build a society based on moral strength and virtue and happiness and community. It's that simple.
Thank you, Mr. Ubersack. Mr. Ostrander.
Thank you. We talked about money in politics. I apologize. I keep forgetting that. I'm sorry. We keep talking about money in politics. Here's a perfect example. The top 200 political corporate givers in 5 years, between 2007 and 2012, gave $5.3 billion to candidates and lobbyists to change the tax code to their benefit. This didn't just start yesterday either. Some of our conservatives tend to forget that one of their peers said debts don't matter. And then one of their other peers, somebody they've lionized, Mr. Reagan, came into office, and he lowered the personal income tax. And we went from under $1 trillion worth of debt, and by the time he left office, we had $3 trillion worth of debt. And in the meantime, he had to raise taxes 11 times in which to try to keep up with the spending that was going on. And we've been on this course ever since then, where government is the enemy instead of a part of a mixed economy.
Thank you, Mr. Ostrander. Okay, then our next question, we are going to go A to Z. The question is, President Obama wishes to allow 100,000 Syrian refugees into the country. Do you support this? And we'll start with Mr. Asajjan.
As a most humanitarian nation on the face of the earth, I think we have some responsibilities, but we need to take a step at a time. Just allowing refugees sounds good, but who are they? Are they real refugees? What gives us the right to inspect their background? I would support it, but not till such time that we know exactly who they are, where they're coming from, where they're going, and exactly what the purpose is for them to be here. But prior even to get to that point, I want to ask the question, why is it that their own folks, such as Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, haven't opened their doors for their own people of the same religion, of the same tradition, of the same culture? Why aren't they going to the nearby countries, which is much easier to travel with their children and with their families, and then to come all the way to America? It's quite a distance. It costs lots of money. There's lots of questions to be answered before we get to that point of allowing anybody to come to the United States for the safety and security of our citizens. We owe that to you.
Thank you, Mr. Asajjan. Mr. Carbajal.
Thank you. We need to first make sure that the European countries are doing more of their share to assist with this humanitarian crisis. I also think we as the United States have a responsibility, and we need to make sure that we, in alleviating and playing a role with this crisis, in helping with the refugees, that we also make sure that American security is paramount and that we provide the proper screening so that as we're helping, we're also not creating safety and security issues in the United States. But absolutely, the United States has a critical role here, and we need to work with everyone in the Middle East and our allies to make sure that they're doing their fair share and demonstrate by example. But yes, the United States has a role.
Thank you. Mr. Farid.
The number one priority that we should have on foreign policy is the security of the residents here within our nation. We've had attacks from ISIS already right down the street in San Bernardino. I think it's important to be cognizant of that and know that when we're talking about what's happening with the crisis in Syria, there needs to be a plan of action to end this crisis. Beyond that, if anyone were to consider bringing in refugees, what then and what happens afterwards? Are they now permanent or are they not? I would not be in favor of it. We need to have a process that exists with people who are entering our country, what their background is, and make sure that they're not ISIS sympathizers. ISIS is a big threat around our world, and it's creating uncertainty in a number of different regions. That's where I am, and there's a lot of thought that needs to go into this, that along with our foreign policy, our immigration policy. So I wish we had 30 minutes to talk about this.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Farid. Mr. Isaacson.
We are a humanitarian nation. So are many of our allies. So I agree that our friends in Europe need to do their part as well. But we are a humanitarian nation. And basically, conceptually, yes, I agree with bringing in the people into this country. However, you take 10,000 people or 100,000 people, where are you going to put them? Yeah, planning has to be done. You can't just dump them nowheres. They have to be provided for either by finding them jobs or initially putting them someplace. Yes, they need to be screened as to who they are. But it does take planning. But the process has to be begun with step number one, is to agree to bring them in here. And then plan on how we're going to bring them in here and find where they're going to go to and how to meet their needs.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Isaacson. Mr. Kokkonen.
The main function of the government is to protect its own citizens. We should not bring people here who are not vetted. Absolutely should not. I know that Mr. Trump made a comment some time ago where he stated he would put a freeze on bringing Muslims into the country. And people misunderstood that comment. I do not want to stop them because of their religious background. It has nothing to do with religion. But Islam is not only a religion. It is an economic, social, legal, political system that is a totalitarian system, every part of which is against our constitution. We cannot bring them in. A lot of the Syrians are military age men, and many of them are deserters. I know this from many phone calls I've made to my European friends. And in fact, the Syrian ambassador to India stated that approximately 20% of them are dangerous jihadists.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kokkonen. Mr. Lucas.
You know what? I really support an international high school program. You can't blame the children of the world for the genocide that's occurring in this world. We have to protect the innocent, and the children are innocent, even if they're being indoctrinated. You have to grab them at an early enough age. I'd like to close military bases, take them, make private international high schools out of them. We fund this by anybody we send foreign aid to. We earmark the cost of each child's education. We offer those associated countries the ability to send their 12 to 14-year-old students here. We now have them here. We teach them 1 year immersed English. Then we teach them 3 years international high school. They go home with a stipend from serving on the base, and they go home with an education, and we all speak English, and we all have a common language that we can communicate in the future with. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ostrander.
Thank you. I'd like to remind our panel that Syrian refugees that are going to immigrate to the United States go through the most heavily vetted process the United States has. It's 22 to 24 months. If you're a citizen of Europe and you could be a jihadist, you can come here on a visa and be not vetted whatsoever. And let me remind you of something that we have in the bottom of our Statue of Liberty. It says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free. What has become of us? Are we xenophobic? Are we really worried about our safety? Because if you look over the last 10 years, there's been 330,000 violent gun deaths, and only 300 people die of terrorism. So I don't care what you feel about gun safety. My point is, isn't that a little bigger issue than 300 people that have been killed, some of them by American citizens themselves? This is a little bit of a straw man issue, and it's xenophobic, and I don't like it.
Thank you, Mr. Ostrander. Ms. Snyder.
This is a major humanitarian crisis here, and we as a country, I believe, have a moral obligation to help those who are in dire need. And of course, they're going to be vetted and making sure that people here are kept safe. I would hate to repeat what this country, I think, shamefully did in the mid-30s and early 40s when a number of Jewish people from Eastern Europe tried to come to the United States, came all the way to the shores and to Ellis Island and other places, and were turned back, and then went into a concentration camp and were murdered. We have to work with our global partners on this very dire issue, and of course, when people come through here, they're going to go through a vetted process.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Mr. Ubersex.
I think it's very important not to be swayed by sentimentality in this issue. Now, I lived with the immigrants of the Muslim immigrants in Europe on a day-to-day basis. I saw the faces of the young men and their desperation who are now fighting in ISIS. We definitely owe something to the people in Syria. We owe them to give them their country back. We should work hard to give them peace and tranquility. We're not going to make up for our errors and those of our Saudi allies who created ISIS and the instability in Syria by trucking in the immigrants here. Europe has brought in the immigrants not for humanitarian reasons, but to prop up the low end of their economic system, to be low-end workers propping up their pension system. Then they treat them like dirt. Don't make any mistakes about it. I've seen it with my own eyes. It's all rooted in economics, veiled with the disguise of humanitarian concern. Give these people their country back.
Thank you, Mr. Ubersax.
We've now reached the point where we are going to be having our one-minute wrap-up, and each person will have 1 minute to reiterate anything that that you feel is important in terms of your campaign. And so we will start with Mr. Ostrander and move on down the table. Mr. Ostrander.
Thank you. Thank you for coming tonight, and thank you for listening to us. I appreciate your moderation, and I appreciate all the questions. The one thing that I would beg you, give us a chance to actually talk to you about these issues, and let's get to the marrow of it. I feel forced tonight to try to just spew out something as quickly as possible and then sit down, and I don't feel like I've really talked to you about some of these issues, and I would very much like to address some of the points these gentlemen made, because it's through that discourse, the creative tension of democracy, that we actually come to ideas, that we actually come to solutions. But right now, in politics, money is playing this role where it's dividing us, it's polarizing us. And if you look at the graph of Americans today, you will see that we are no longer this pyramid shape with most people in the middle. We're like this. And one reason for that is because ideological and consistent voters are more than twice as likely to give money to campaigns. We must get money out of politics. I encourage you to go take a look at my website, ostranderforcongress.com, and read about money in politics. Read about climate change and agriculture's role in it. Read about student debt and about wealth inequality.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ostrander. Mr. Ubersacks.
Thank you. I'd like to ask you to just visit my webpage, where I've laid out in a simple outline form my position on all of the platform issues. I want to emphasize again that if we want to pay for... The big mistake our country made was in the 1960s, where we tried to have war and welfare. We can't do both. So we have to eliminate the war. Then we'll have enough money to implement all of these other progressive programs. I want to also exhort you to embrace the power that you have as a single moral agent. It doesn't matter what everybody else does. It doesn't matter how many votes I get. The welfare of the universe morally depends on your action. You can change history, you, by voting for peace. My last point is to exhort us all to a renewed sense of unity. We're being divided by outside pressures and turned against ourselves. Unity is our greatest strength. Let us be of different minds, but of one heart.
Thank you, Mr. Ubersacks. Mr. Lucas.
I don't know if you've all seen a copy of The Solution on the way in, but I prepared a comprehensive package answering most of these questions and highlighted all the answers. It's a 9-page package you can pick on the way out. It deals with energy, North American infrastructure, education, gun control, immigration, and education or employment. I hope you pick one up and take the time. You can reach me at thelucassolutions.com. I really enjoyed being here. I realized the time was going to be short, so I hope you do pick up the package, read it thoroughly, and I hope I've been able to sway at least one vote tonight in here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lucas. Mr. Carvajal.
Well, in closing, I just want to thank you for having this wonderful forum and opportunity to share a little bit about ourselves. I shared with you a little bit about my story. I know what it's like to be an immigrant to this country. I know what it's like to struggle. I know what it's like to be able to get ahead and work hard, get a good education, serve my country in the United States Marine Corps Reserves. I want to be able to make sure that working families, middle-class families here on the Central Coast have every opportunity I had. I want to make sure that we are able to help families create ladders of opportunity so they could pull themselves out of poverty and into the middle class, and make sure we're expanding opportunities for the middle class. And make sure that we're doing everything possible to grow the economy, that we're investing in our education system, making it more affordable, addressing comprehensive immigration reform, addressing one of the most significant challenges of our lifetime, climate change, protecting Social Security and Medicare. I want to make sure that, well, in closing, well.
Thank you, Mr. Carvajal.
I want to thank all of you for being here again this evening. I wish we did have more time to talk. I'd encourage you to visit justinfreed.com to get more information. Please reach out to me. Visit us on the social media channels that we have.
This election, in my opinion, is the most pivotal election that we've had here on the Central Coast and, frankly, for the future and the direction of our country. It's necessary that we send people who have a long-range vision of how they're going to solve the problems that we face for this and the next generation, that we have people there that care more about the next 10 years or 20 years from now than they do their next election. You hear a lot of empty rhetoric coming from folks. One of my opponents talks about strengthening the middle class. However, he's voted for an increase in budgetary spending every year that he's been in office. He's increased fees and taxes on middle-class families. So I question how that's going to happen. We've talked about the institutional policy reforms tonight to get Congress working again so that we can reduce wasteful spending, rein in the regulatory burdens, and begin to invest back in America again. Please consider voting. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fareed. Ms. Snyder.
Thank you so much for taking the time and being such a great audience, and I really hope I have the opportunity to meet with you one-on-one, or please feel free to go to HeleneSchneider.org or at Mayor Helene if you tweet and follow me around there. And I really appreciate is talking to people in smaller groups and in groups like this to really get to the core of the issues, because I think that's what matters. I think people are sick and tired of the dysfunction in Washington, that they're tired of the Washington establishment telling elected officials what to do and how to do it. And I can promise you that I will listen to the residents and the voters of the 24th Congressional District, do my homework, and then be not only a strong vote for you, but a strong voice on bringing the issues that we know work well here and onto a national stage. If that gets me into a little political trouble with the Washington establishment, then so be it, because status quo is not good and we need to change it. And I'm your person for that. I hope I can earn your vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Mr. Asajjan.
Thank you. I also want to thank you ladies for the forum tonight and everybody for attending. A little over 5 years ago, I went to Sacramento. We were $26 billion in deficit. With bipartisan spirits and hard work, we don't have that deficit today. I take the same spirits with me to Washington to take care of our almost $19 trillion deficit for the sake of our children and grandchildren. Ladies and gentlemen, I've been self-employed now as we speak for 38 years. I don't need a job, but there is a job needs to be done. I have the unmatched experience to get that job done for you. I'm a living proof of the American dream. I want every one of our children and grandchildren to have the same opportunity. Thank you for your time. I respectfully ask for your support.
Thank you, Mr. Osaldin. Mr. Isaacson.
Thank you all for coming tonight, and I hope you've learned something about all of us. And I'd like to again thank our hosts for putting this on. But I have one more thing to request of all of you. The only commodity that makes any difference in the coming election is your vote. The money, yeah, that makes it easier for name recognition. It makes it a lot less work to get their names out there. But voting is the only thing that counts. So I'd ask you all to think about what you heard tonight. Look at everybody's website. Do whatever you need to do the homework, to understand what everybody's about. Donor lists are public record. So look at who everybody's donors are and find out what obligations they may be under when they get there. Then think about which candidate is going to
vote for you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kokkonen.
Thank you all for coming here. Thank you for hosting it. Several years ago, I had a case that went to the United States Supreme Court. It was a matter of the 10th Amendment on limited government. Did the federal government have jurisdiction or state government have jurisdiction? I believe in limited federal government, and my case was heard by the justices, and I'm here pleased to tell you that Mr. Scalia wrote my opinion, and all eight other justices concurred with it. I won with a unanimous decision. I'm willing to and have acted on principle. That matter did not provide any financial reward for me, but I acted on principle even though it cost me a huge amount of money. Politicians here have talked about how they have balanced the budget. Well, the way they balance it, let me tell you, as a financial planner, they balance it by having a secret account in which they haven't needed to fund money, which is their unfunded pension liability. San Luis Obispo has millions of dollars, and Santa Barbara has billions of dollars.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kokkonen. I want to thank all of our candidates for coming this evening, and some of you have driven a very long way, and we really appreciate the opportunity to be able to meet you and to get to know what's important to you. And I know it's difficult to answer many of these questions in 1 minute, but you've all just really stepped up to the plate, and you've really been able to punctuate the key aspects of what each one of the questions was asking. And so we appreciate that very much, and thank you. And to the audience, I'd like to say thank you all for coming. You put together some very good questions, and I appreciate your willingness to sit in a crowded room. The one thing I would ask is take a look at the websites, and if you haven't registered to vote, please do so. Please vote, and know that you can take home this sheet and be able to watch the performance. Yeah, there are some listed outside.
Yeah.
Good meeting you.
Nice meeting you, too.
Thank you so much.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. President. Thank you.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Thank you for coming.
We had a few questions.